What's going on, y'all? This is Justin, host here of Embodied. We did promise you an episode where we would discuss the events of the last couple weeks, and so this is it. This is the Nat Turner episode. We also get into a lot of stuff about the last couple weeks. We're here again with Brittany Barron, and she's going to be helping us process some of this, the violence that we've been witnessing, what to do with it, in light of spirituality, etc., etc. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at EmbodiedCast. Share the podcast, hashtag EmbodiedCast on Twitter, on Facebook. Our group is facebook.com/groups/EmbodiedCast. Send us an email, EmbodiedCast@gmail.com. Put a review on iTunes. Leave some comments. We'd love to hear what you guys think on the SoundCloud page. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the specific episode. We hope that you enjoy this. We've been working on it for a little bit. And we hope that it's another step in this conversation as we move forward. So, without further ado, let's get started. Okay, what's going on? It's Justin here with
Brittany.
Yes. If you remember, Brittany had a couple episodes. Fire.
Straight up fire.
Fire. But today we're going to be doing something a little bit different. I reached out to Brittany asking her a couple of weeks ago, before all the things that went down, even.
Yeah, it was.
It was, yeah. I was like, yo, can we do this podcast on this graphic novel? And so she was like, for sure. And I was like, dope. And yeah, so now we're doing the podcast, but we're doing it also in light of everything that has been going on in the country in the past couple of weeks. And so I don't know, we're going to talk about a lot of stuff. We're going to attempt to tie it all in. But yeah, this is our attempt to do that.
Yes. Attempt. Key word. Attempt. I'm still processing. I'm not one to ever turn down a free book.
Yeah.
So when you texted that, I was like, of course. And then when I was reading it in light of current events, I was like, why did Justin do this to me?
I didn't do it on purpose. Let's just state that for the record. Yes, it was not on purpose. So basically the book that I actually asked her to take a look at is actually a graphic novel. It's called Nat Turner, published in 2008, illustrated by and written by Kyle Baker. It's under the Harry Abrams Book Press. You can find it on Amazon, all those, IndieBound, all those places. And it's deeply connected to the American story. And it's based off of the Confessions of Nat Turner, which was published in 1831. And actually, Nate Parker has made a movie called The Birth of a Nation, which is coming out in October 7th, 2016. And so we just kind of thought, oh, it might be interesting to have a conversation about a slave rebellion. And then everything in this nation happened. So, yeah, like I said, we're going to try to tie the two together. And so first, let me give you a brief history for some of us lesson, for some of us history lesson review. So Nat Turner, okay, he was born a slave, October 2nd, 1800, Southampton County, Virginia. He was a deeply religious man. In 1821, Turner ran away from his overseer, and then he returned after 30 days because of a vision in which he saw the Holy Spirit telling him to return to the service of his earthly master. I know, crazy. Okay, so then 3 years later, Nat's work on the plantation working, and he has another vision where he sees some lights in the sky and he prays to find out what they mean. And then he describes in his confessions as saying that while laboring in the field, he discovered drops of blood on the corn as though it were dew from heaven. Okay, so that's two visions in. And then on May 12th, 1828, he has his third vision where he hears a loud noise in the heaven, and the spirit instantly appeared to him and said that the serpent was loosened and Christ had laid down the yoke, etc., etc., etc. And then by the signs in the heavens that it would be made known to him, that's Nat Turner, when he should commence the great work. And until the first sign appeared, that Nat should conceal it from everyone. So he shouldn't tell anybody about this sign that he was about to find out about what the work was or whatever that, you know, whatever the heck that was. Okay. So the basic thing, though, at the end of this vision was that the spirit told Nat Turner that he should arise and prepare himself to kill his enemies with their own weapons. And so, of course, the enemies here would be his slave masters. And then in February of 1831, there was an eclipse of the sun. Turner took this to be the sign, okay, that he was looking for. And so he told four men, his trusted friends, the plan. And then on August 13th, there was another atmospheric disturbance in which the sun appeared bluish green. And Nat took this as a final sign. And a week later, on August 21st, Turner and six of his men met in the woods. They ate dinner and they made plans. At 2 o'clock that morning, they set out to the household of the slave masters that owned Nat Turner, and they killed all the white people there as they slept in their beds. They continued on from house to house, killing white people they encountered. And every time they went somewhere, they would take the slaves and have them join their group. They killed women, they killed children, they killed babies. And in the end, the rebels had stabbed, shot, and clubbed at least 55 white people to death. So that's the story of Nat Turner. If you want to find out what happened specifically to him, did he succeed, did he not succeed, you can A, read the graphic novel, B, check the movie out,
C, Google.
Google. Or D, all of the above.
Yes, because I think I would suggest.
I would suggest all of the above, because we got to support this media, you know what I'm saying? But I think, you know, as we sit here and as we've been reading this and looking at it over, looking over it, the question also is, like, doesn't this transfer to today? And I remember as I was listening to Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly, the last track on there is Mortal Man, and it's his interview with Tupac. And he's talking, and here's what they say.
Would you consider yourself a fighter at heart, or somebody that only reacts when they back is against the wall?
I like to think that at every opportunity I've ever been threatened with resistance, it's been met with resistance. And not only me, but it goes down my family tree. You know what I'm saying? It's in my veins to fight back.
All right, well, how long do you think it take before you be like, we fighting a war, I'm fighting a war I can't win, and I want to lay it all down?
In this country, a black man only have like 5 years we can exhibit maximum strength. And that's right now, while you a teenager, while you still strong, while you still want to lift weights, while you still want to shoot back. Because once you turn 30, it's like they take the heart and soul out of a man, out of a black man in this country. And you don't want to fight no more. And if you don't believe me, you can look around. You don't see no loudmouth 30-year-old motherfuckers.
That's crazy. Because me being one of your offsprings of the legacy you left behind, I can truly tell you that it's nothing but turmoil going on. So I wanted to ask you, what you think is the future for me and my generation today?
I think that niggas is tired of grabbing shit out the stores, and next time it's a riot, it's gonna be like bloodshed, for real. I don't think America know that. I think America think we was just playing. It's gonna be some more playing, but it ain't gonna be no playing. It's gonna be murder. You know what I'm saying? It's gonna be like Nat Turner, 1831, up in this motherfucker. You know what I'm saying? It's going to happen.
That's crazy, man.
Okay, so Tupac says this, you know, a couple years ago. It's not like he just said it, but it's, you know, it's coming back into the air, so to speak, you know, culturally. And not only that, you know, we have the movie coming out. And so I think the question comes up for me, you know, why don't we talk about Nat Turner? Why haven't we heard of Nat Turner?
Yeah. You know, so the way in which Tupac references Nat Turner is essentially how I've always heard about Nat Turner. Like, Nat Turner has a line in the narrative of life of Frederick Douglass. There's a line about Nat Turner in the autobiography of Malcolm X. Like, there's lines about Nat Turner. So literally, and I consider myself someone who wants to be well-versed in history, in Black history, and what we've done. And so literally all I knew before I picked up this book was Nat Turner led a slave rebellion of some sort in the 1800s.
Yeah.
Which is, like, reading it and learning more about it, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is important. And we don't, I mean, Black History Month in school, like, it's Malcolm X, it's Martin Luther King. I mean, you never hear about Nat Turner.
I mean, maybe Malcolm X. Maybe, I feel like Malcolm doesn't even get much play.
No, it's really just Martin had a dream, everybody write down your dream. Okay, back to European history. But I know why we don't talk about Nat Turner, though.
Oh, yeah?
It's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's wild.
It's scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is interesting. Go ahead, sorry.
No, no, go ahead.
But yeah, so it's interesting that it's scary to us because presumably what's scary is the fact that, you know, a man killed a bunch of people, right?
Right.
You know, but interestingly enough, we have no problem talking about the American Revolution.
Exactly.
You know, and so one of the quotes I found online was talking about, like, how this fear that comes up in Americans, you know, when we talk about celebrating the defiance of law, you know, when somebody revolts against the law, we think of that as being, like, unpatriotic, even though, you know, the spirit of revolutionary America, you know, what could be more patriotic than fighting for one's freedom? And that comes from the Howard Zinn education program. But, like, I think that's a good question, you know? And then all this stuff happened in America, and that question becomes even weirder, you know? And what does it mean to fight for freedom? But yeah, maybe tell about your experience. You talked about this. We talked on the phone a couple days ago. But, like, talk about your experience of reading the text personally.
Yeah. So I was reading, there's so many layers. So I read the book, and, you know, it is a graphic novel, so you can go cover to cover in an hour or so. And so I just had this full, like, Nat Turner experience, I felt like, and was left literally, I didn't know what to feel. I thought one of the main questions, I was like, so is this man a hero or the villain of this story? And it was crazy. And so I don't even think I told you this, but I'm reading it, and my girlfriend there, she was doing, like, other work. I was reading the book. I finished it, and I was like, I have to tell you about this book. So I just start blurting out the whole story of Nat Turner to her, right? She's white, okay? She's, like, grew up in Orange County. She's super down, but, you know, she just has that lens as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, this and this, and then I'm like, and then he did it. Like, he really did it. He went in and killed everybody.
And I mean, that's not funny, but, like...
Exactly, but yeah. This is my tone when I'm saying it, because I'm like, it's wild. And she was like, are you excited? Are you saying you're excited? And I was like, what? No, what? I can be, like, it was the strangest conversation.
Yes, yeah.
We had this really hard moment, because I'm like, 10 minutes ago when I set the framework for the book, and I talked about the slaves that would just jump off the boat because they were so hopeless and people were dying, you weren't offended.
Yeah.
Until I got to Nat Turner.
Right.
Turning up and killing everybody. And that is what I think some of the same feelings I have, like, current day. Like, so my brother is a cop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love him deeply. So what's going on right now with, with the shootings with of police officers is terrifying. Obviously, because I'm thinking about my brother. I'm thinking, okay, he's a target now because of the uniform he wears. But that process for me is no different than the same mourning that I feel for my black brothers who are getting the same treatment. So I hate the police shootings just as much as I hate the shootings of black men, right? Like, and that's what's upsetting, is because people are outraged when Nat Turner just is killing people, and people are outraged when these cops got killed. But my goodness, Christopher Columbus literally has a holiday.
Yeah.
Statues all over this country.
Stamps, the whole nine.
Right. Thomas Jefferson. We got slave owners on our money. We have just somehow made them not out to be monsters that they were.
Yeah.
And so slavery is just something that we're supposed to accept. Like, good people were also slave owners. But was Nat Turner also a good person who...
Turned the tables? Well, it's not even that he, like, turned the tables. I mean, yes, he did turn the tables. But I think what's even more interesting, and the reason why I wanted to talk about this for this podcast, because as a podcast, we talk about the intersections of spirituality and identity. But, like, the deep, deep spiritual component to this, you know?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's different than what we're seeing today. We're not seeing people saying, you know...
God told me to do this thing.
So that's a big difference. And I think that's, to me, initially what drew me to this story for this podcast. And in general, is like, you know, this guy said that he had a vision that God told him, the spirit told him, that I should arise and prepare myself to slay my enemies with their own weapons.
So
what do we do with that? Because he's a preacher, essentially.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this was the wild thing, because there's another section in the book, which we'll talk about this later, but he escaped. We could talk about it now also. Yeah. But he escaped and he said the Lord reminded him of the scripture of slaves obeying their masters. And he went back. At that part in the book, I was like, I'm putting this thing down. Justin has me reading this nonsense. But
this isn't woke. What the hell is this?
I know. So, but then you have this institution of slavery that is being powered by the use of scripture and Christian rhetoric. And it's awful. It's literally awful what they did to black people in the name of scripture. So you have this atrocity. And then you have someone coming around saying, well, I'm going to kill you now, but I'm also driven by scripture. I was like, does everybody have it wrong? Does, you know what I mean? What?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, and then it's hard because you look at the Old Testament especially, and you see so much violence.
Yeah.
You know, and I think some people would say, like, in the Christian tradition, that's why we look to Jesus as our model and not, you know, the older models of the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I just think it's, you know, even like in a Jewish framework, you know, how would you process, you know, how do you process the violence, you know, and the idea that God ordains or God supports or God is on the side of those who commit
redemptive violence or whatever that
yeah,
means.
Right. Yeah. You know, yeah.
Yeah. And I don't even know. It's really hard to reconcile because, you know, I think a lot of us have this picture of Jesus more passive than peaceful, right?
Yes. So what do you mean by
that? So it's almost the idea that, like, I feel like our popular narrative of Jesus kind of means he wouldn't do anything.
So, like, give an example.
Okay. As I'm processing this, I'm like, what exactly? So Jesus had, we don't see Jesus being violent in any way, but we see Jesus standing up strong against certain things.
Can I disagree with you?
Yes.
Okay. So interestingly enough, I'm not going to disagree with you. I'm going to like play devil's advocate.
Go for it.
When you say we don't see Jesus being violent, you know, in today's cultural narrative, mm-hmm. I think what he did in the temple would be couched as violence, because that's what happens in our current situation. I'm not talking about the police shootings. I'm talking about like previous situations where, you know, gas stations have burned, CVSs have been burned, so property has been damaged, and that is couched as violence.
Sure. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So I agree with you. But that's what I'm saying is, I just feel like we have reduced Jesus to, I feel like modern day popular evangelicalism in America has reduced Jesus to someone who would never turn something over or destroy something to see. And when I say violence, I guess I mean like human to human.
Yeah, no, like totally. Yeah.
But we have reduced Jesus to someone who is just kind of like, oh, I'm just going to go in my house and pray. When we have this kind of aggressive force coming up against all these systems. And so it's so interesting to me how, at least in this, like how I feel like this, what was going on in Nat Turner has literally just carried on through Christianity. And it's here still today.
Yeah.
Of you have, you know, so I don't know. It's so hard to think about what has been done in the name of God.
Yeah.
And how we reconcile that with now how we interact with God and justice and all of those things.
And so what was your experience in terms of like, so I think one of the things we think about, you know, with Nat Turner is like when we read violence, when we read rebellions and all this stuff, it's kind of anesthetized. It's kind of like not numb, but not whitewash is not even the right word. It's just kind of like, mm-hmm. it just kind of like goes in one ear and out the other.
Yeah.
And one of the things that the graphic novel kind of shows you is the graphic nature mm-hmm. of what he did, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, when he killed entire families, you know, and what, like, so what, yeah, what do we do? I'm trying to get probe a little bit deeper even into like how we process violence even as Americans, you know?
Well, this is what was interesting to me as I've been processing. I lead a civil rights tour like every year. I do all these things, so I see a lot. You know, if you've ever seen 12 Years a Slave, any movie, I feel like I've seen and read about and learned about the slave experience so much. It's upsetting how little it affects me. So in the beginning of the graphic novel, it's showing people being captured from Africa. It's showing the journey on the slave ship. It's showing people dying and people being sold. And I was like, okay, yeah, I get it.
Seen it.
And then it starts showing pictures later in the novel, you know, when Nat Turner and his crew are going off. And I was really affected.
Yeah.
And part of me was like, I'm kind of mad at my girlfriend because she's having that response. But I'm having a similar one of the slave images weren't shocking. So I'm like, is that just because it's something I haven't seen? Is that internalized racism? Now all of a sudden I feel sad that these white families are dying. Like, you know, I was really conflicted about like, why is this hitting me harder than seeing black people in chains?
Yeah. And I think this goes back to one of your earlier points is that, you know, we're conditioned, you know, you and your own self, you know, feel grief about the death of these officers and also about the death of,
right,
you know, black folks. But we're conditioned to not have that kind of dual caring, you know?
Yeah, like we have to care. Like, you know, you see slavery and what you just hear people say is that's the way it is. That was just what people were doing then.
Yeah. It was a sad state of affairs, but
but it is what it is. But these families, they didn't do anything to deserve this. And I even, like, I talked about this on the other podcast I was that we did about how some of these narratives that I don't even believe have worked their way into my psyche.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I kind of feel like that was true. Like, even with what's going on right now in America, you have, well, he should have been, we have the justification of the killing of black men, right? Well,
yeah.
This is the way it is. And if you don't do this, one of, you know, you'll, that's why they got shot, you know, but then these officers, they didn't do anything. And I agree. The families in this book, the kids in this book, and the police officers today, they didn't do anything. They were part of a system that has been rolling and oppressing people. But I'm just saying, how is that more sad than what's been happening to black people in this country?
Hmm.
Like, I just want it to be equally sad.
Yeah, I mean, and it brings up a good, at least to me, it brings up the point of, you know, if they're equally sad, then, like, what's the solution? You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, if, and I'm not saying this, I mean, I don't know the answer to this question, but I don't know personally if it doesn't feel like that's a sustainable relationship, you know? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, black folks get killed, police officers get killed. You know, like, there's a kind of back and forth narrative doesn't seem, not even narrative, it's not even narrative, it's like a reality, you know? This kind of back and forth thing doesn't seem to be societally sustainable. Like, we can't just, I think that's maybe one of the reasons why, mm-hmm. you know, Dr. King was such a proponent of nonviolence, mm-hmm. you know, and that, you know, and part of that was, you know, the influence of Bayard Rustin on him, you know,
yeah.
I don't know if you've heard that story, but like where Bayard, you know, King, you know, had dudes with shotguns at the front door early in during the boycott. And Bayard said, you know, not just because of the fear of reprisal, but principally like we need to be about nonviolence because that's going to be the way forward. And, it seems to me like, you know, the narrative even we hear now is like, don't quote nonviolence. Don't tell us about King's nonviolence. You have no idea, you know, what we're going through, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm even wondering, like, does, you know, nonviolence have, what's the role of nonviolence in all this stuff? You know, like, would King look at Nat Turner as a villain, or, you know, as meeting, rising to the standards or dropping to the standards of, you know, the mm-hmm. current system that he was in.
Yeah. I mean, quick side note, I was just telling someone should make a movie about Bayard Rustin because he was like the man behind, but then he was gay and it was like a big scandal, but it was like, he was leading that thing.
Yeah.
Anyways. Well, what's, I mean, because even Malcolm X gets portrayed as this like violent, crazed man, but he didn't, I mean, even what he was saying was so mild from Nat Turner.
Well, he didn't do anything.
Yeah, he was saying, if you come at me, like, I'll protect myself.
Right.
I'll use violence, you know, this whole by any means. But Nat Turner was like, I don't care who you are, where you came from. Like, you're going to get what's coming to you. I'm going to give it. And it's so, I just wonder if there, it seems like violence is the only option, especially when violence is what you're experiencing, right? So someone is like, you know, tapping you. You're not like, I wonder if I just turn around and walk away, if they'll stop tapping me. You're like, I'm just going to tap them back. You know what I mean? That's, you know what
you're saying, that's natural. That's like happening. a natural human.
Yes, like, okay, you're doing this to me, I'm gonna do this to you. But I think, I mean, personally, I think a nonviolent revolution is less likely to be threatened by violence, right?
So explain that.
So someone more famous than me, I think a long time ago, said I'm paraphrasing. Like, but basically a violent revolution will always be threatened by violence, right? So if we overthrow something by violence and then they get stronger and then they use more violence and then they, and you know what I mean? And you're just kind of playing
And that's
that
what we
game.
See happening.
Yeah, we're in that game right now.
Yeah.
And even with Nat Turner, after his revolt, they killed 200 blacks.
In retaliation.
Yes, in retaliation.
And it was the justified, those are justified as well. Like, those are seen as being justified killings in the eyes of the people who did it.
Exactly.
Because, you know.
Because of what just happened.
Right.
And so, it's hard. Like, still to this day, when I watch videos of the sit-ins, and they're pulling people and throwing milkshakes in their face.
And I'm coffee
like,
and yes, hot coffee.
Spitting on people, water hoses with kids. But what I do think, honestly, is if you are able to attain change and this sort of revolution through nonviolence, it won't be threatened by violence. So you use your violence, and that still doesn't stop the movement. Now the movement has to happen.
Hmm.
It's idealistic, but it is what I believe.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think holding to ideals is what makes us, you know, pushes us towards to evolve, you know,
yeah.
And to break some of these cycles. I mean, that's true in an interpersonal sense, like, you know, holding to ideals that maybe I can be a better person mm-hmm. is why I do self-care and work, you know, yeah. Like if yeah, I was just like, true. Well, this is just who I am and, mm-hmm. you know, I can't be any better than what I already am, you know, then that's not going to get us far. I think interestingly enough, too, is, you know, in the narrative today, you know, Black Lives Matter, you know, people don't even understand like what it is or who's involved or who's connected. Yeah. You know, there's always people being misassociated with the movement, with the network, with all this different stuff. But anyways, all that being said, one of the interesting things is that like I feel like I see and hear a lot of people talking about the violent nature of the Black Lives Matter movement,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I don't know if part of that is like, oh, they see blocking freeways and airports as a type of violence or mm-hmm. something like that. I don't know. But even if they did, I feel like that's ridiculous. But what do you think about that? When you hear, you know, that in light of just reading this, like this, I mean, if you want to talk about violence, like this is violence. Like what Nat Turner did was violence. Even like, you know, yeah, what Nat Turner did was violence. That was real.
Yeah.
Black
That's
violence.
As violent as it gets.
You know. So what do you think about those types of comments when you hear, you know, yeah. the demonization of the movement in its current form?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's again, it's so scary. And this feels like conspiracy theory-esque. Maybe it doesn't, but I think white people understand in this country the oppression of blacks. Whether they want to say it or not, they do.
Yeah.
And so the idea that black people in this country would stand up and say, no, no more, I think is terrifying. And I think some of that comes out in the rhetoric. When you see hundreds of black people walking down the street, I guarantee you white people, whether they mean to or not, whether it's intentional or not, they get scared. That's a scary sight.
So do you mean all white people or not all white people?
Yeah,
or
not all white people.
But like, I get what you're saying.
I will say the majority of Americans, the way we have been socialized to understand mm-hmm. What the media has told us, what historically the images we see, the stories we hear, I feel like a lot of Americans have been socialized in a setting that produces fear of the black man and black people in general. And this is what, you know, I was telling someone this. This is like a little bit of a tangent, but we were talking about Tamir Rice. And I was like, they shot a 12-year-old kid, a child. But I think here's how it might have happened, honestly. Someone did see him playing in the park, and they were scared.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they, I don't think the cops woke up like, I'm going to kill a black kid today. But the person who was called the police was frightened, was afraid.
And that came off in their call.
Yes, that came off in their call. The police heard that. Now they're afraid. Now when they pull up on the scene, it's already escalated. And that's what we see in so many things happening. And that's why it's so dangerous, is because all of this is relegated to the subconscious.
Yeah.
I really don't think that most of the racist incidents that we see happening are not, they did not intend to do that when they woke up in the morning. But to bring it to Black Lives Matter, the same thing happens. You see hundreds of black people coming down the street, I guarantee you it produces fear. Yeah. I don't care if they're chanting, "We love babies." You know what I mean?
Yeah.
People see that and they're like, "That no, that's dangerous. It's scary." If a single black man walking down the street and you lock your doors, what do you think you're going to feel when you see hundreds?
Yeah. When you shift to the other side of the road, you know, to cross the street, and clutch your purse.
When your daughter can't date a black man, what do you think you're going to think about this movement where they're taking over freeways?
Yeah.
I don't care how not, and we see that. It can be the most nonviolent, literally just walking.
Yeah.
Just walking.
Just being in a space.
Mm-hmm. Too many in one space. They're up to something, you know.
You know, it's interesting. I'm thinking too about when we talk about violence, you know, this nation is a very violent place. I mean, we're talking about a place where shootings and killings happen all the time. And, but in terms of, you know, how we respond to specific types of acts of violence, especially the ones that are politically charged, I'm thinking about what Malcolm said in response to JFK's assassination, mm-hmm. and how much trouble he got in for that. But I'll read it here. He said, President Kennedy never foresaw that the chickens would come home to roost so soon. But being an old farm boy myself, chickens coming home to roost never made me sad. They always made me glad. And so it's just very interesting because he got in a lot of trouble for saying mm-hmm. that. But, you know, whether or not you agree with the sadness and the gladness part, you know, I think the idea of chickens coming home to roost is essentially like actions have consequences, and, you know, violence begets violence, you know. And so that's not to say that I'm glad that the violence is happening personally, me, Justin Campbell. But I think it's to understand that, like, we shouldn't be surprised that we are in this violent cycle. You know, like, what have we done? What have we actually done to prevent this? What kinds of work have we done to actually mm-hmm. prevent and break this cycle of violence? And this is like, whether it's, you know, between police and black communities, within the black communities, we're doing good work, I think, you know, but we're not finished yet, is basically what I'm saying. Because, we're not finished with this work yet. We still have a lot of work to do. And I think that's basically one of my biggest issues, is that people are kind of like, why are we still talking about this? We got this all figured out. And I'm like, well, if we had it all figured out, will we be having these types of incidents all the time?
And that's what, you know, I think that's something I've been thinking a lot about, is we have to understand the layers. Like, we have an issue in this country with guns, okay?
Yeah.
And this is not a race issue. I'm saying we have a gun issue across the board, okay? Like, we are a nation obsessed with guns. People lose their lives in this country at a shocking rate, okay?
Yeah. It's compared to the rest of the civilized world, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who's more civilized? Anyways, we have a race problem in this country.
Yes.
We have a serious race problem. We have a problem in this country. I think we have I'm going to be careful how I word this, but we have a theological problem mm-hmm. in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we're seeing right now in some of these movements is the three of those converging. So our gun problem, mm-hmm. our violence problem is meeting our race problem, is meeting our theological problems, and it's kind of becoming this hotbed,
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because we have issues that happen that touch on one or a couple of those, but this is, I feel like...
The intersection of...
Yes. And it's frightening, but it's very easy to understand. I know exactly why we are where we are.
Yeah.
I know how we got here. I know... You know what I mean? Like, it's not crazy to understand. And when people, specifically white folks, say, oh, you're just, you know, I always like to reverse the question, what would you suggest?
Yeah.
Like, what would you suggest happens now?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
What's like, your solution?
Yeah. I want to know, because we need one.
Yeah.
Maybe you have it. But we really need to understand, I mean, we're... Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when the question arises, you know, why are they killing cops?
Mm-hmm.
Not that. And when they say they, I think there's a misunderstanding because I think like the they is connected to BLM, which isn't true. But like this idea of like, why would you kill a cop?
Yeah.
You know, like you said, that the answer to that question isn't like, I don't know. The answer to that question is, the intersection of all these deeper subconscious systemic problems that we have not fully addressed as a society, you know, we've just kind of let them go and let them be, you know, fester. And so, you know, the solution to all this isn't like cracking down on activists and, you know, whatever, you know, like,
I don't think any of these things are super difficult to understand. Like, I understand, I think, how the police shootings of black men. That was a confusing way to say that. But I understand how they got there.
Yeah.
Like, I understand why. And I understand why the retaliation shootings have happened.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand the man who was guilty of the Pulse massacre, why he did that. I mean, there are very few things happening in the world right now that you can't understand.
That don't make sense.
Yes, it doesn't make them right. It doesn't make them, I don't agree with them, any of them. But I get why it's happening. There's very clear lines we can draw to very specific things that have happened historically that are happening now, which puts us at the place where we are.
And so now that we kind of, if we understand that, what do we do now moving forward? You know, because I'm like, you know, like we're both saying, I'm not a proponent of violence. I don't think the solution is a violent Nat Turner-esque thing. You know, what Tupac was saying, I don't know if he was advocating for that. I don't think he was. I think what he was saying is, you know, if you keep poking the dog, it's going to bite you, you know. But what are some, you know, if we want to avoid more violence, massacres, shootings, killings, you know, this, you know, what are some solutions that we can, going forward, kind of attempt to put into place?
I feel like part of it is, I mean, so you and I are so committed to this work, to this understanding, that we can say, yeah, I understand how that happened. I don't know that that's true for, so even the, I don't know why I keep using this example, but even the officers who shot Tamir Rice, I don't know that the trail events that I was saying is that probably heard the fear. I don't know that they could pinpoint that. And that's a problem. So I don't think we have enough. Like you just, like we talked about at the beginning of this episode. When it's Black History Month in school, everyone says, okay, Martin had a dream. Write down your dream for the world. We don't grow up in this country with a legitimate understanding of our own history, how that influences how we see people and how we treat people. I think if we had a better understanding overall, is a step towards kind of doing that. I think America literally needs to apologize for slavery. We've wiped it under the rug and said, like, that was a long time ago. I was just talking to a friend about their trip to Berlin, and they were just saying, like, Berlin is a city apologizing for the Holocaust. Like, you walk around, and you don't go very far without a sign, a tribute, a memorial, something saying, hey, just so we're all clear, we know that was wrong. We're sorry.
Yeah.
I was in Selma last year.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a guy on the corner selling posters. There's not a memorial. There's not a city. The bridge in Selma is still named after a KKK leader.
A Grand Dragon or whatever.
Yes. Yeah. Grand Dragon. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Whatever. And so we have not gotten to a place as America where we say, hey, just so we're clear, we all know that the Confederate flag still flies in this country.
We're still having a conversation the legitimacy of flying the Confederate flag.
Exactly. And so I think as long as we, in terms of a greater nation, are trying to hold on to our respectability, like slavery never happened and it wasn't as bad, like we didn't eradicate almost all of the indigenous peoples that were here before, like we aren't doing things, as long as we try to hold on to that facade, I mean, things are going to keep bubbling up.
Yeah, until we address those things. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I don't know a ton about German history,
mm-hmm.
but my sense of, you know, having gone, I was in Munich and I went to Dachau, which is the concentration camp mm-hmm. there. My sense, you know, in going and visiting is that the kind of apologetic nature, you know, that you're mm-hmm. describing is not something that Jews had to like fight for. You know what
right,
I'm saying?
Right.
They didn't have to be like, you know, marching in the streets. You know,
mm-hmm.
when you see those things are done by Germans for Germans.
Yeah.
As a way of saying never again, mm-hmm. you know, never again will we do something like this. And I think, you know, the attitude of Americans, of America, I don't want to even say Americans because like, what is America but Americans, you know?
Yeah.
But the attitude of Americans, I think, is kind of what you just said. Like, and I like to compare my visit to the concentration camp to my visit to plantations in Louisiana outside of New Orleans, you know?
That are still holding weddings.
Yes.
With black servants.
Yes.
Because
you know what I'm saying? Like, when you walk into Dachau, you know, there is a deep cloud of regret, of pain, of, you know, seriousness, of recognizing the horror of what went on there. It's not a joke, you know? And that not a jokeness is not something that the Germans are kind of like, we have to do this because, you know, if we don't, you know, the Jewish people are going to revolt, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They do it because they, deep in their own selves, recognize the horror of what they did. And when you walk on a plantation and it's like, would you like a mint julep? And that's the depth of, like, you know, what is talked about, mm-hmm. you know? That, to me, is the problem, you know? We don't read stories like Nat Turner. We don't watch 12 Years a Slave. We don't do these things. We don't think about how terrible things actually were.
And the crazy thing is, so, you know, whenever I'm in the South and I'm going to these museums, I'm going to these different places, it's mostly black people that are there.
Right.
But second, I just really want people to understand that one of the worst things this country has done, okay, coming out of it, what we have are so many people in our country literally fighting not for an apology, not fighting for more memorials, not fighting, but fighting to keep pieces of that history alive. Literally, I want the Confederate flag. I want this plantation. I want my high school mascot to be the Confederates. We want to still be like the Redskins. We're fighting. That's part of, like, what is happening? That I'm sorry, but we have like wounded, hurt communities. We have genocides. We have enslavement. We have the worst things you can do to a group of people. America has done to multiple groups of people, and here we are, 2016, and we have Americans fighting for the right to keep that as a part of their lives.
Yeah,
it's insane.
Yeah, and fighting to keep these types of stories out of educational systems,
exactly,
and things like that. And so I think that kind of resistance, you know, I think that's a huge part of the problem. I mean, I think, you know, when we go to Washington, D.C., like I used to take students to Washington, D.C. for eighth grade trips. And when you go there, there's a Holocaust museum, you know. So even if you don't go to Munich, even if you don't go to Berlin, you can go to the nation's capital in Washington, D.C. and go to this huge, huge museum that maps the entire history in detail, in graphic, gory detail, mm-hmm, of the Holocaust. And it's a very powerful, it's a very moving experience. And I actually would recommend that folks go to it, because it actually impresses upon you the horrors of the Holocaust, right? Why don't we have a national slavery museum in DC? And I'm not talking about a national African-American history museum, because mm-hmm, we need that too. But we need a Ma'afa, mm-hmm, museum. You know, we need a museum in which, you know, eighth grade children go right after they go to the Holocaust Museum, you know, so that they can understand this happened here. And, you know, I think it's easier for us to talk about the Holocaust as Americans because we're the heroes.
Oh, 1,000%. You know? It's easy for us to talk about anything. We love talking about international drama.
Yeah. I mean, we like talking about the Holocaust because we're the ones who liberated some of the camps, you know. It's much harder for us to talk about the realities of slavery, not just in terms of, like, you know, the South, but how slavery was a part of the building of America in general.
Well, and this is, I'm going to mess up these numbers, so sorry. But, you know, my dad was just talking about this the other day. So Malcolm Gladwell, right? He wrote that book Outliers, and he highlighted something called the 10,000 hour rule. So it takes 10,000 hours to become an expert in something. And once you become an expert in something, it's said that when asked how you do it, you only offer up about 30% of what it actually takes, because 70% of how you do it is relegated to your subconscious. So if you ask Michael Jordan, who became an expert, about put his 10,000 hours in, how do you, you know, take off from the free throw line and jump and put one hand in the air and one behind your back and dunk or whatever? He would give you about 30% of how he actually does that, because the 70% is relegated to his subconscious. So for 353 years, assuming that from 1619 to 1954, assuming that in 1954 everything changed, which, of course, it didn't. But if you think about the nation intentionally, with purpose and practice, intentionally practiced, we'll just say segregation. We won't even say slavery. Let's just say segregation intentionally for that long. That is about 310,000 hour units. So America became an expert about 300 times. So we know what that means. We know that if you ask someone, oh, how do you keep the races segregated? They're going to give us about 30% of how they did that, because 70% of how we became experts in segregation has been relegated to our subconscious. Now juxtapose that, assuming everything was great in 1954, assuming everything changed, we've only been practicing integration for 63 years.
We didn't even do it till like the 80s.
Yeah.
Because and we haven't been
practicing it. So we have a country that 70% of our expertise in racism and segregation is relegated to everyone's subconscious.
And 70% of that expertise is in being racist. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, exactly.
We're not in, you know, peace, love, joy, nonviolence. Mm-hmm. It's in violent racism.
Yeah. It's steeped in, and we just have to start acknowledging that. That's all I'm saying is, hey, maybe if we understand what's going on, maybe if we acknowledge and everyone accepts the Confederate flag is extremely offensive. I can't imagine how you would want to fight, but I can if you spent, you know, 310,000 hour units becoming an expert in flying that flag and what it means. Yeah, it makes sense.
So I think that's a great place to end today. Because I think that's the question moving forward. You know, this violence is not new. These cycles of violence are not new. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, are we going to actually address the deeper issues? Mm-hmm. Or are we just going to keep watching this happen and keep saying, I don't know how this happens?
And if the answer is no, I mean, things will calm down in a few months. They will.
Yeah.
And they'll blow back up again at some point in 2017.
Yeah. Or even 2016.
Yeah.
You know, unless we do something about the intersection of issues that you just mentioned, mm-hmm. That's actually the real problem. Unless we treat the actual problem, these symptoms are just going to keep flaring up. You know? Well, Brittany, thank you for coming through.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. Always a pleasure.
It's a tough conversation.
Yeah.
And I don't claim to have all the answers, and you know,
I don't even claim to know the full extent of the question.
Yes, I would say that too. But I think that part of the thing we can do is keep having these conversations.
Absolutely.
And hoping that eventually we'll get to a place where we don't have to have this conversation because we're actually addressing the things, you know, that make these instances happen.
Yep.
So anything last words?
Everybody listening, learn some history. It'll change. It'll change you.
Yeah.
Every new piece of history I learn is actually changing me deeply. Yeah.
And that you're doing your 10,000 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, until next time.
Until next time.
Peace. So yeah, we want to thank you for listening. Got into a lot of stuff here. So if you have questions, comments, make sure you hit us up on all the different platforms, social media, email, the whole nine. We'd love to continue this conversation. If you have questions about solutions, questions about things that you can do, we'd love to have that conversation with you. Directly to the resources we know. And if you have resources you want to contribute, we'd love to see those as well. Thank you again for listening, and we'll see y'all next week. Embodied is produced by Justin Campbell with production assistance from Carlos Antonio Delgado, Jason Jenkins, Delisa Perry, and Philip Yaw Dumfe. So until next time, peace.